I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And a look at how a nation's history lives in its own clay. See, there's a potter in North Carolina, a fellow by the name of Sid Luck, who can trace his roots all the way back to just after the Civil War. That's when his great-great-grandfather, William Henry Luck, began turning pots in Seagrove, North Carolina. Back then, it was a simple business, making the kind of pottery that people need in everyday life.
Somebody had to provide vessels for the community to store their food in, prepare their food in, and that sort of thing, and the potters did it, and they were primarily farmers that made the ware, used the clay to make usable ware for the community. And they made churns and jugs and crocks and pitchers and those kinds of things that could be used for, like, milking the cow in the crock, let it set and clabber to make butter. They made churns to churn the butter in and jugs to store syrup in, cider in, any liquid that would keep.
Any of that pottery from that time still around?
Oh, yes. I actually have a piece that my great-grandfather made, and it was rare that anybody signed any back then, but once in a while, because he was refuted to be somewhat of a rascal anyway, but there weren't too many people at that time period, the Civil War era, a little after, that could read and write in that area. But he was from an old Confederate family. And he had been educated. He could read and write, and he would write his name on a piece once in a while.
On the bottom of the pot, as we'd see
today?
Yeah,
the one I've got's on the side. It's a large jar, a cylinder-like bowl, and it'll hold about a gallon to a gallon and a half. It's just got straight walls, like a straight wall cylinder with a lid that fits over it, that a guy found up on the Virginia line. Said, "Have you ever heard of this fella? Or do you know who this is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's my great-grandfather." And so he asked me what it was worth, and I told him I didn't know, whatever somebody would pay for it, I guess. But he took it back, and about 3 months later, he showed up with it again and said, "I think this ought to be in your family. Would you trade me a rooster?" I'd made a rooster.
A clay rooster,
yeah,
right?
A caricature of a rooster. I'd had several up. He said, "I'd like one of those roosters. Would you trade me a rooster for it?" And I said, "Absolutely."
Sid Luck's own experiences making pottery started when he was quite young and not entirely as a volunteer enterprise.
My father said that my brother and I, he was 8 and I was 10, that we had no business hanging out in swimming holes and fishing holes after the crops got laid by, and that my brother and I were to learn how to do pottery. And so I was sort of forced. My father put me right on the wheel, and you know, he would show me how to try to center it, and then I just took it from there. And it's a long process to learn how to do that, but I just determined that I was not going to allow it to whip me. I think it was important to him that I be made aware that this is part of my heritage.
I was going to ask you if it was just keeping a tradition alive or if your father was sending you down to the basement to make something useful.
Yeah, I think it was more about keeping a tradition alive. At that point, the need for all such as what we had made prior to that was gone. It had been replaced. The market had been replaced by commercial potteries, and they did all the work, made all those vessels that were needed, and, you know, dinnerware, as well as any kind of storage jars or whatever, plus the glass industry had come along, and he had mason jars to store food in, and so there was really no need for it, but he didn't really like it when he was growing up in the early 1900s. He did not like doing it because it was Depression years, a lot of the years, and he said, "I've never done so much hard work for nothing in my life as making pottery."
You remember watching your father, what he could do well?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He was good. He liked to turn larger pieces. He didn't care for the smaller stuff. Of course, as a small person at age 10, 11, 12 years old, I couldn't make the really large stuff, but he liked to turn a ball that weighed no less than 6 pounds, which is a pretty good chunk of clay.
No kidding. And you and your father would go get the clay?
Yeah, I remember going to the almond clay pond and digging.
Sure. Hard work?
Oh, yes.
I have clay in my garden. I hate to dig in
that. Yeah, it's terrible because you stick a mattock or a pick in it, you know, it sticks to the thing, and you have to pull it off a lot of the time because it's very, very plastic, very gooey, I guess. It feels like Play-Doh.
Tell me what it was like when you started working on the wheel. What do you remember?
Well, my my, I guess, most vivid memories were that it was really hard, and there are probably still splotches of mud smears on the basement walls where I would sling mud up against the wall out of, I guess you'd say, disgust. But, yeah, it was tough, but it was something that I took as a challenge, and I said, I'm not letting it whip me. I'm going to do it.
What did you make when you started out, though?
By the time I was 12 years old, I could make 200 ashtrays in one day, whipping out ashtrays. And I made another piece that I started, and they would only have like a 3/4 of a pound of clay in those. But another piece I would make, and I think it only had a 1/2 pound, was a little hot butter dish, which was just a little dish. It had a little lip on one side, and you'd stick it like a stick handle. I mean, it'd be a clay handle, but it looked like a stick on the side to pick it up with, something to melt butter in. I started out with those two pieces, I remember.
200 ashtrays a day. I mean,
yeah, well, that's some kind of boring.
I was going to ask if it was
yeah.
boring.
Yeah.
Did you make any money doing this?
No.
You no pocket money at all?
Well, I made a little. I mean, but, you know, relatively speaking, it was not very much. I used to tell people years ago I couldn't have bought a used Studebaker with all the money that I ever made. And when I was 12 years old, I mean, I felt like something really special with people in there just bragging on me when I was standing there just whipping out ashtrays. They couldn't believe I was doing it.
You were a tourist attraction.
I was. I was.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Sid Luck continued to work on his pottery through high school, working at the Cole Family Pottery Shop, one of the few places selling traditional North Carolina pottery then. When it came time for graduation, Sid decided to go into the military since he knew he'd be drafted eventually. He signed up for the Marines.
I think I got out of high school on Friday, and I was at Parris Island, South Carolina on Monday. So, yeah, it was a
In Marine boot camp.
I was. I started out at Parris Island, South Carolina, ended up at Camp Lejeune for some infantry training, San Diego, California, San Francisco, California, Spain and Italy and France and Cuba. And I got sent from Cuba to Southeast Asia to, I called it the Promised Land.
Wound up in Vietnam, did you?
Yeah, I did.
How long were you there?
I was only there 7 months, but it was the end of my enlistment. And I wasn't about to re-enlist.
Tough times.
Yeah. It was really difficult then.
And I suppose that was a 4-year period of time where you didn't actually do much pottery.
Well, I did, because I was stationed at Camp Lejeune down here actually for about 2 of those years. And when I was not on a cruise in the Mediterranean, I would come home on weekends and work at Cole. So I constantly did it, yeah.
Interesting that you would keep that up.
Yeah.
It's not something that you think goes with the Marine.
No, it certainly wasn't.
Sid Luck served 4 years as a Marine, twice as long as if he'd been drafted. When he went to college, he realized he was good at chemistry. Sid figured he'd get a steady income as a chemistry teacher, and he was happy doing that. He really liked working with the kids. Working with the administration, that was another story.
I guess I was somewhat prejudiced by the Marines in that I remember an old gunnery sergeant saying to us as we left for Vietnam, when you come back, you can kiss the ground and say, this is your country, you've done your duty, and it's your country. And when I went into teaching, it didn't take me very long to realize that everybody that was giving me permission to go to the bathroom, my administrators or whatever, had been these guys who predominantly majored in P.E. in college and just got a draft deferment, so they didn't have to do any of that. They were draft dodgers. I'm not sure how this reflects on me, but I didn't have a lot of respect for them.
And they were the ones giving you orders, right?
They were the ones,
right?
My bosses telling me what to do.
Was there one afternoon, one incident with a vice principal where you just said, you know what, I don't need this anymore?
Yeah, actually, it was with an associate superintendent, I guess. I had gotten a letter instructing me to attend a seminar on teaching earth science. I did it. It's 3 days. Not only that, I had to pay my motel bill. They didn't pay it. So I come back to school that fall, And it take me a couple of days to get ready for the kids, but we had 2 weeks sometimes, or a week anyway, to get ready for them. And I just thought I would ask and say, hey, can I take some comp time? So I went to see the associate superintendent, and he hit the ceiling. I just made a scene about that I would even dare to ask that question. No way. So, yeah, that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. I said, well, I'm kind of teetering anyway. This is it. This will be my last year.
How long had you been thinking that you'd sooner be making pottery than teaching? Had it always been in the back of your mind?
It's always been there, because the pottery always trumped everything. I mean, I used to tell people, in the absence of my wife, it was my first love. And for what
she may hear this.
I know. Well, I actually have done it before.
She's probably heard it before.
Yeah.
But why the draw? I mean, you could put in your teaching and turn a pot in the evening or on the weekend. What was it about pottery that pulled you so strongly?
It's the sort of immediate gratification that I get from doing pottery, that I can take just a amorphic lump of clay and make it into a form that's very pleasing. And it's almost immediate gratification, in contrast to teaching, which I like teaching. But the teaching thing, I never really knew who I was getting through to. I mean, not really. I gave tests, as does every teacher. But what a test tell you? That's sometimes not a lot, I think. But years later, I mean, even 15 years later, I get gratification from teaching, because I had a vet come by one day. Mr. Luck, I am so glad I had you for chemistry, because it was so helpful to me to get through the undergraduate into vet school.
It's a long time to wait for that
gratification,
but
and
nice when
dentists,
it comes.
I've heard a couple of dentists. So, yeah, but that's years and years later.
But when you're making pottery.
Yeah, it's instant. I mean, it's right away.
I am curious about one thing, Sid, and I know that a lot of other people will be, because, you know, many of us do what we do and think about something else that we could be doing. Wouldn't it be great if I could be a pilot or a painter or something like that? And here I am in this office. How hard was it to put aside what was in effect a career as a chemistry teacher, because you've been doing it for nearly 20? How hard was it to just put that aside and say, now I'm my own boss?
Yeah, it was difficult, because my father... My father told me I was crazy as hell.
Wait a second. This is the father who told you to be a potter when you were 10 years old.
I know. But he said, you'll starve to death doing this. You know, you're wasting your education and so on. So
he was serious about this.
Oh, yeah. He was serious about that. Yeah, that it was really a dumb move on my part.
What did you say to him?
I said, well, I can use the chemistry that I've used. I can make glazes, because my family never had any colorful glazes till I came along. And so I immediately started formulating colorful glazes.
So did your father ever say to you, maybe it wasn't such a bad
idea?
He never did.
No.
Too proud a man?
Or? Right. Absolutely.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Sid Luck's pottery shop is a local attraction now. He'll often turn out 20 pictures in a day.
I say nobody's made an original form in 10,000 years. But I have these forms. Like, I make a lot of buttermilk pitchers, because I like to carry on the old tradition. Yeah. I make churns, and I make jugs. Actually, jugs are probably my favorite piece to make, because they're still somewhat challenging. You have to pull up a cylinder and then close it off, or shape it out a little and then
close the neck off a little bit and then open it up again.
Yeah. So those are right much of a challenge.
And 50 years in, you can still be challenged by a jug.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That interests me. I would have thought that you could do them one-handed.
Well, most of the time, but I mean, it's just not a given when you start that you're going to get through. Most of the time I do. I don't fail in probably 5% of the attempts, but it's still, you know, that possibility's there.
And what would your great-grandfather, Henry, think about the work that you're doing now? Because it's pretty different from the stuff that they were making 100 years ago.
Yeah, well, he was refuted to be a real stickler for making pieces really smooth. When you turn a piece on the wheel, you leave little concentric circles. We call them finger tracks, particularly on the inside. And he he was refuted to be a real stickler for getting those out. He even made him some round chips so they wouldn't have any finger tracks inside, none inside or outside.
And that was the mark of a good piece.
That
for
was
him.
The mark of an excellent piece of pottery. One of the things he might say about some of mine would be, "You left some finger tracks in them," because I'm not that much of a stickler.
But the other thing that's changed, though, Sid, is that what they made for function. What
right.
you make is not for function anymore, is it?
Pottery is something that's one that I love doing, my passion, but I don't feel like I do anything that anybody needs. I do things that people want. So
why do you say nothing that anybody needs?
Well, I guess I grew up in a poor environment where what you need is something that will keep you alive and keep you going. To have things that were not necessary.
The idea that a buttermilk pitcher would be made and then set up on a shelf for everyone to look at wasn't something.
Right, it's sort of a waste of time. you only do things that are necessary to keep yourself and society going.
I wonder what's the one thing in your day now, working as you do as a full-time potter, that gives you the most pleasure?
Just taking that ball of mud and spinning it into a wonderful shape. That's still the most satisfying thing that I do.
But it interests me that after all that time, it's just that act of having your hands on the clay
mm-hmm.
that gives you that much pleasure. I wonder if it is something that you've inherited from generations before you.
I wonder that too. I remember when I went to college, they said that you did not inherit your social traits from your ancestors. But I think there may be some instinctive behavior that is passed on through genetics that does mold your emotional being, your spiritual being.
Certainly seems to be the case in the Luck family, doesn't it?
Yep.
Sid Luck has been carrying on the legacy of the Luck family pottery, and now his sons are in on it too. One of them even worked with him at the pottery shop. But Sid's most lasting legacy may be the 5-gallon whiskey jug that he plans to have glazed with his own ashes once he's left this earth. Put it up on the shelf with that old lard jar. If you have any suggestions of stories that you'd like to hear us take a look at here on the program, I'd love to hear from you. You could get to me through our website at thestory.org, or just leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.